following is a presentation of Refuge Calvary Chapel Huntington Beach with Pastor Bill Welsh. For more information about our ministry, please visit refugefamily.com.
Mark your Bible, if you would, at 2 Samuel chapter 6, but we're going to start in Psalm 24. Study today, the title of the message is God in a Box. Can you believe that? God, would you try to put God in a box? We're going to look at that this morning. So if you'd stand with me, Psalm 24, I invite you, if you'd like to read out loud with me, but start at verse 1, we'll read all the way through. It's just 10 short verses. Here's what David wrote. This one was probably written, by the way, for that time when David brings the box back in to Jerusalem. So he writes and he sings, "The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein, for he founded it upon the seas and established it upon the waters. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to an idol, nor sworn deceitfully, he shall receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. This is Jacob, the generation of those who seek him, who seek his face." Selah means stop, pause, think about that, dwell on it. "Lift up your heads, O you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." Who is the King of glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Read verse 9 and 10 out loud, strong with me. Here we go. "Lift up your heads, O you gates. Lift up your everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. I don't know why, but whenever I read that verse, "lift up those gates," I just see a garage door opening up for some reason. One more time, read verse 9 and 10. "Lift up your heads, O you gates, and lift up you everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. Selah. Father, help us this morning to think about that, to dwell upon that, that invitation to open up the gates and let you come in. So Lord, come this morning in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Have a seat, please. You ever feel like you just forgot something and you don't know what it was? What's your typical pose when you do that? You know, you grab your head, you massage your temples. What am I forgetting? And you run through your day and you get down the road and you realize what it was. I walk in the morning quite often, and I love to walk in the wetlands. I don't always get up in time, so sometimes I just walk out the door and I walk over this way and I walk around Belaterra and I'll walk across the parking lot over there at Golden West College. And I don't know if you're like me, but there's still probably a little bit of a kid in me that if I see something shiny on the ground, I pick it up and I stuff it in my pocket. Remember doing that as kids? And you came home with worthless stuff, pockets full of worthless stuff. Well, I got some stuff that I picked up over there. I picked up the tops of a couple of coat hangers. Something's not working with these missing. I found nuts and bolts and washers. I found money. I found hair bands. I didn't pick up the hair bands, but all kinds of stuff. And I wondered what stopped working when that great big nut fell off of somebody's car. They got down the road and thought, something's missing. What happened? And maybe you've been at that place in your life where maybe you're good at losing your keys. How many, fess up, are you good at losing your keys? Anybody good at losing your car? How many of you have lost your car before? You got to the mall, you couldn't remember where in the world you put the thing. Once I get to Westminster Mall and I just get turned around in that place. And you can't remember which parking lot you put it in. How many of you have lost your wallet? How many of you have lost your smartphone? And that's basically saying you lost your whole life, right? Everything is in that smartphone, everything, your schedule, your numbers. Do any of you have the numbers, the phone numbers of your family memorized? Yeah, not anymore, we used to. I used to have them all right here, all kinds of numbers. But how many of you have lost this? It was 1982, I think it was. And we were pastoring a church in Desert Hot Springs, and we had Sunday night services. And so, after the service was over, I said, all right, kids, everybody go jump in the car. I was parked out at the curb. And so they go running out to the car, and Joy and I come out. We jump in the car, and I turn it on, and we pull away. And I just felt like something's missing. Someone is missing. Someone is not here. And we left our son behind in the church. He was at that time, I think, about 4 or 5 years old. We went back, and he was curled up asleep underneath the front pew of in the sanctuary. Picked him up, still sleeping, and his sisters had to tell him that we left him behind. He never would have known, could have gotten away with that. He still loves to dig me on that story. But if you ever felt like something's missing in your life, you know how David feels now. It's exactly how David is feeling. Something big is missing, and he knows exactly what it is. It's a storage bin that's missing. It's just a box. He knows right where it is, too. It's not like it's lost. He knows exactly where this scary, important, sacred, holy, mysterious box is. He knows exactly where it is. It hasn't been forgotten by him. It was forgotten by Saul before him. For 40 years, at least 40 years, Saul didn't even care that much about where the ark was or whether or not to bring it back into the nation of Israel or into Jerusalem or wherever he was at that time in Gibeah. Why not bring it there? Why not bring it back to Shiloh? He had no concern that we can see at all for that box, that receptacle, that bin, that storage bin. It was just gone. But to David, it's different. He knows where it is. It just isn't where it belongs. It's not in the spot that it was designated for, at the center of the nation. It was meant to be front and center, the core of the nation, which is now Jerusalem. It was meant to be right there. So David sets off to bring the Ark of God home, that box. Now think about what David has up to this point. Let's just kind of review this young man's life. Think about what he's accomplished by this time. He's one of the most gifted people you would ever meet. The question isn't what can David do, it's like what can David not do? He does everything so well. And he's accomplished incredible things in his life. And by this time, he's the head of the whole nation of Israel, probably upwards of 3 to 4 million people by this time. He's rich and he's powerful. I mean, he's a king. He's got a massive army at his beck and call, as they say. He can do anything he wants. He can have anything he wants. He's been chosen by God, anointed by God. He's got a close relationship with God. Think about this. He talks to God. God talks to him in detail. Which way do I go? What do I do today? Do I go north? Do I go south? What do I do? And he's got this incredible, intimate, close relationship with Yahweh. You can call him Jehovah if you want. Yahweh, they're both good guesses on how the name of God might have been pronounced. But he's got this close relationship with Yahweh where they talk back and forth. He's got a growing family. I would suggest that he's got a bigger family than he should have had because he's got more than one wife, and that's all the wives he needed. That's all the wives God ever intended for a man to have. But he has begun to stack his wives up and gather relationships that he shouldn't have. But he does. He's got a huge growing family, and he's taken the stronghold of Jerusalem, the center of the nation, and he's made it his capital city, but now he wants more. He wants it to be more than just the political center of the nation. He wants it to be the spiritual center of the nation. And so he wants something more. He wants an old box. Keep your finger there in 2 Samuel. We'll be back there, but flip over to Psalm 132. David had made a vow, and it's recorded probably by somebody else, unless David inserts his own name in the song that he wrote, which is not unlikely. It's one of the songs of ascent, and it's one of the songs that is like the culmination of the songs of ascent. They're coming to Jerusalem to worship, and as they approach this wonderful city of Jerusalem, they remember why they're coming, because the centerpiece of their faith is there. The centerpiece that says something to them, this Ark of the Covenant is there inside the tabernacle or inside the temple. And it starts like this: Lord, remember David and all his afflictions, how he swore to the Lord and vowed to the Mighty One of Jacob, surely I will not go into the chamber of my house or go up to the comfort of my bed. I will not give sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids until I find a place for the Lord, a dwelling place for the mighty one of Jacob. Then he says this, very interesting. He said, "Behold, we heard of it in Ephrathah. We found it in the fields of the woods." What did he find? Read on. "Let's go into his tabernacle. Let us worship at his footstool. Arise, O Lord, to your resting place, you and the," what's the word? "Ark of your strength." What did we find out in the field? What was just sort of stuffed in a corner of the field in a sense? It was the ark. What's it doing out in the field? Kind of abandoned, just almost discarded. We can't really find anything in Scripture where there's a scene of people gathered around the ark wherever it was. When it was gone, it was just gone. And David said, "I'm not going to rest until I bring it home, until it's right back in the center of our culture, our society, until we again as a nation are gathered around the ark." He made this vow. That's what my life is all about. And it's not an ordinary box. This is the Ark of the Covenant. Listen to this. I found this online in the Jewish Virtual Library. And it reads like this. "As a general rule, Judaism rejects physical manifestations of spirituality." In other words, religious hardware. No statues to worship. "Preferring instead to focus on actions and beliefs, worship of graven images is harshly condemned throughout the Torah. Today, Jews do not venerate any holy relics or man-made symbols. But in the history of the Jewish people, there was one exception to the rule. One man-made object was considered intrinsically holy, the Ark of the Covenant. Constructed during the Israelites' wanderings in the desert and used until the destruction of the first temple, the Ark was the most important symbol of the Jewish faith and served as the only physical manifestation of God on the earth." That box. That holy, scary box. You read through your Bible, you will find four arks mentioned in the Bible. What's the first one? Noah's Ark. Noah's Ark. What did it mean? It meant salvation. It meant we start over. Another a family is saved and will begin this journey of humanity all over again. They were tucked safely into what was really no more than a floating box. The word ark, by the way, it means box or chest. Just like a holy chest to put something in. First one is that floating ark that saved the human race. Second ark, who knows what the second ark was? It's also a floating ark. It's a whole lot smaller. Might have been about that size. It was the ark that Moses was saved in. Very good, Jolene. Jolene knows her Bible. Get close to this lady. She knows the word. And when the edict went out, kill all the baby boys, Moses' mama said, "Not my baby boy. You don't get my baby boy." And she had a box made, and she covered it inside with pitch, then covered it with fabric, and she put her little baby boy Moses down in there and floated him down the river and asked God for that protection. He was saved, salvation, again, in the ark. The next ark is this ark that we're talking about this morning. That box, that chest that held certain holy items, that was the focal point of their faith and their religion and even their worship, although the box itself was not worship. Now, there's one other ark that's mentioned. I said there were four. The other one is in heaven. It's in Revelation chapter 11. And it says that when we get to heaven, we're going to see the original, I think, the original ark of God. Because whatever's in heaven, there's a replica of it here on earth somehow. But the one we're looking at this morning is this box that is sort of typified by this thing that's up here. Let me unveil this to you, as if you didn't know what was underneath this. A storage bin. Doesn't that look holy? The original one was covered with gold, but it was about the same dimensions, just a little bit under 4 feet long and just a little bit under 2 feet wide and 2 feet deep. It didn't sit on a stand. It probably had its own legs on the bottom or just sat on the foundation of the tabernacle. And it was there to remind the people of God. That he was among them, that he was for them. His box had many names. As you look at it through Scripture, it's called the Ark of the Testimony. It's called the Ark of the Covenant because of the covenant God made with his people. I love this one, though. It's the Ark of Yahweh. It's the Ark of God. In one place, it says the Ark of Yahweh's strength, the strong God that was with him. It's the centerpiece of the nation of Israel, and it was meant to remind them of who was in their midst. It has, by the time it shows up with David, almost a 400 to 500 year history from the time it was first constructed. It was built after the escape from Egypt. Here's a couple of artist depictions. Which one do you think you're going to see here first? Indiana Jones and the Lost Ark. They got it right on the replica and even the size of it. You had Spielberg helping them, and there's a Jewish, you know, director and producer of the movie. Let's get this thing right. And the Nazis are destroyed as they cart the Ark away. But it's probably not different from actually what it looked like, except we don't know exactly what the cherubim on the top of the ark looked like. And I think it's really interesting that when God told them to make the ark and put a couple of angels on the top, who had ever seen an angel? How would they know what to make the thing look like? If you're the artist and you say you've got the job to make a couple of sculptures of angels with their wings outstretched, touching one another, hovering over the top of the ark, what would you make it look like? Well, there's all kinds of differences of opinion on what it looked like. Some of them are more gnarly than others. I don't know what that looks like. Big wings coming up over the top. It's very ornate. This one looks like Billy Bob did it and stuck it on a paint can on the back porch and just sort of left it off there in the corner, which is maybe not far from the truth where it was when David found it in the field, found it kind of discarded, but it was something like that. Now, more importantly, I want to talk about what was in the box. Some of you know what was in the box. Let's just go down through the list. There was the testimony of God was in the box, the truth, the commandments of God, the 10 that he had given them. Some Jewish scholars believe that the first copy of the Torah, the first 5 books of Moses, was rolled up and put in there as well as they moved it around, but there's nothing to indicate that. But the 10 commandments, the stone tablets were there. Aaron's rod that budded, Aaron's almond rod, which was his staff, it was his walking stick. He'd cut it out of an almond tree. And one day, for God, in the process of God saying something to Aaron and to Moses about his presence and his power and his purposes, he let a dead twig sprout new life. I think that's significant. There's truth in the box, and there's miraculous life that's in the box. There's provision in the box. There was a golden bowl of manna in the box. And that spoke about the fact that God's going to provide for you every step that you take. I'm with you. I'm the God that feeds you. I'm the God that protects you. I'm the God that leads you with truth. I'm the God that gives you life. What was on top of the box? What did we call this lid? The what? It was the mercy seat. I love that. That is all topped off. Inside there is the law that kills me because I can't keep the law. But hovering over the law is the mercy of God with this protection of these heavenly angels. Over the box is the mercy seat. What was over the mercy seat? No man could construct this. What hovered over the tabernacle by day and by night? There was fire, there was cloud, there was something of the glory, the kabod, the glory of God that dwelt upon his tabernacle and dwelt in the midst of his people. Wherever they went, and he said to them, I'm with you, and you follow me. Now, question, was God in the box? Was God really in the box? Hello, God. Was God really there in the box? Is that where you'd go to visit God? Yes and no. There was definitely something divine. There was a divine presence that had something to do with that box. God allowed something of his presence to abide there in that holy place in the tabernacle. But the other side of it is absolutely not. Because when David says, God, I'm going to build you a house, and the conversation, God could have said, you're going to build me a house. How big do you think that needs to be, David? You're going to build a house to contain the God who can't be contained? So God in his mercy allowed something of his presence to abide there, but the full presence of God could never be contained in a box. But it was this. It was a visual profile of God. It was a visual profile of God, and it was there in the heart of their tabernacle. Look up here on the screen. A couple of things to show you on the tabernacle. Whenever the children of Israel moved through the wilderness, when they stopped, they all camped around the tabernacle. Now, the tabernacle itself is not that fence, that sort of fabric fence around it. That's the tabernacle in the middle. The holy place, which has 2 parts to it, the holy place and then the holiest of all inside. I'll show you a sketch in a moment. But they had designated places that they all were to camp out on certain sides of the tabernacle once the thing was set up. Now, looking over it from above, the floor plan of the whole complex was this, and it wasn't huge. It would easily fit inside of this room, dimension-wise, square-foot-wise, easily would fit inside of here. The outer court, you'd come in through a veil that was out here on the edge of it. You'd come in, there's sacrifices, there's water basin there for certain religious purposes. You walk through another veil into the tabernacle itself or the holy place, and then only one man, only once a year, the high priest, he would go inside the Holy of Holies, and he would make an offering before God in the holiest place of all. Could you imagine the privilege of doing that? God was there dwelling among them, blessing them with his presence everywhere they went. Through those 40 years, they didn't move unless the presence of God moved, the tabernacle moved. And the beginning of the procession was to take the veil that separated the holy place from the holiest place of all, take the veil down, and it said when you drop down the veil, you cover up the ark so nobody could see it. And the ark then would lead you on your path. The ark that spoke about the presence of God. So nobody had ever seen it. Most of the Jews had never even seen the ark itself and what it looked like. It went before them into battle. It crossed over Jordan River before them. They carried it around the walls of Jericho. As the walls came tumbling down, they set it up there in Shiloh with the tabernacle, it says in Joshua chapter 18, and it stayed there all the way through those years until the end of Eli's reign. All the way through the time of the priest of Eli, and then disaster struck. You can go back and read it yourself in 1 Samuel 3, 4, 5, and 6, and 7. It was a terrible disaster in the nation, in the history of the nation of Israel when the ark was taken away from them. What's the big deal about the box? The box represented God's presence. It said something so profound to the people of God, so that when they're in this battle with the Philistines, and it says they were losing and they couldn't figure out what's the problem. Somebody said, oh, we need to go get the ark. Let's bring the ark right into battle. And when the ark came into the camp of Israel, everybody in the camp of Israel said they shouted out loud and so much that it frightened the daylights out of the Philistines. Said, what is that all about? They said, somebody brought the ark. They brought the ark into the battlefield. You know what the Philistines said? We're dead. We're dead. We can't handle that. We don't know who their God, and they said it like this, who their gods are, but their gods are bigger than our gods. Their gods who part the Red Sea and kill all those Egyptians, we're dead. But they weren't dead because God had a lesson to teach his people, and they lost that day. Terrible slaughter in the people of Israel. And then the most devastating thing that could have happened. Not only did the Jews lose, but the ark was taken away from them. Look up here on the screen. It went on a journey. We won't go all over this step by step. You got to read that for yourself. But the ark went on a journey for about 7 months. And the Philistines tried to settle down with the ark, and God said, I'm not settling down with you. You may think you got me, but I got you. In fact, I got you right where I want you. And God does more damage all by himself with the box than the armies of Israel could have done to them. So they take it captive in right near Aphek. We talked about that before. They take it down to Ashdod, and they march the Ark of God into their temple to Dagon, the fish god. Yeah, we got you, God. We're capturing gods now. And then we're collecting gods here. And so they set up the ark before, as if it's worshiping, as if the gods of the Jews are now worshiping Dagon. They get up in the morning, and the statue of Dagon, bam, flat on his face. He said, that doesn't look right. So they set him back up on his feet again, had to help their god get back up on his feet. And the next morning they come in, not only has he fallen down, his hands have popped off and rolled over to the threshold. His head has come off. God decapitated Dagon, the fish god, and his head rolls over to the threshold, and they said to one another, we got to get this god out of here. And so they move it down the road. It goes from Ashdod up to Ekron. The people of Ekron say, we don't want it. And then the most bizarre things, let's not dwell on this too long, because it's just strange. But tumors start to break out. In fact, the Hebrew word there is quite literally hemorrhoids. So let's not dwell on this very long, but it became painful for the people of the Philistines. They break out with these, whether they're tumors or whether hemorrhoids is just another word for all kinds of these growths on their body. And they say, we got to get this thing out of here. And it goes from one town to another. People are dying all over the place. these diseases, these plagues that come upon them, says the hand of God was so heavy upon them, they said, let's send it off to Beth Shemesh. So they do it. Somebody says, how do we send it back? Well, let's put together a new ox cart, a couple of new cows that haven't been, I don't know if they hadn't been milked yet or they hadn't been something. They were fresh. They were young. They weren't babies, but they were young cows. So they take their little calves away and they hook it up to the ox cart. They put the ark up on top. They say, well, we should send it away with an offering. Well, what should we send to God? What should we send to Yahweh? Well, why don't we make some gold tumors? Isn't that a wonderful gift to give someone? Honey, what would you like for Christmas? Oh, maybe a gold tumor. Why don't you just gold plate a tumor for me? Ooh. But gold tumors and gold rats, and they put them in a box, and they send it off to God as if he wanted that. And it says, now let's see which way it goes down the road. So if it goes to Beth Shemesh, a Jewish town, we'll know that it was God that did this to us. If it just kind of wanders around, then it all happened just by chance. We have nothing to worry about. So they send it back, and guess where it goes? It goes to Beth Shemesh. People of Beth Shemesh say, oh, wow, we wondered what this thing looks like. And it says they peeked inside. What's in there? 70,000 people died as God breaks out upon them because they manhandled it, taught it. They treated it like it was a toy box, not a holy box. 70,000 of them died. They said, we got to get this thing up the road. Got to send it back. And it goes up to Kirjath-Jearim, and it stays there. It says 20 years, but that's just the beginning of its stay because it's gone 50 to 70 years there. It's in exile. It's almost like God has put himself in exile by himself. But there was something that happened at the beginning, I think, was very profound. When the ark was taken captive, the news goes back to Eli, the priest. He said, bad news, Eli. Bad news on all fronts. There's been a terrible slaughter of your people. Your sons are dead. And the ark of God has been taken captive. It says that Eli, interesting, Eli, when he heard that the ark was taken captive, not when he heard that his sons had died, not when he heard about all the slaughter, but when he heard that the ark was gone, it said he fainted. He was a big guy too. It says he was a very big guy. He fainted, fell off his stool, broke his neck, and died. His son Phinehas, who had died, had a wife who was pregnant. And it says when she heard that news that her husband was dead and the ark of God had been taken captive, she gave birth to the son. She died in giving childbirth shortly after the boy was born, but she lived long enough to give that boy a name. Anybody remember his name? Ichabod, which means the glory is gone. The lights have gone out. The glory days are over. And then she died. The glory had departed. It had been lifted. The glory of God had left the people of God for 50 to 70 years. Now David is ready to bring it back where it belongs, near him, in the tabernacle. In fact, he wants to camp out in the tabernacle. This was intriguing to me because it takes me back to his mentor, Samuel. Samuel was the living legend in David's life. Of all the stories of what God had done throughout the nation of Israel, there was one living legend, and that was Samuel. This guy who started, like David, as a little boy, living in the tabernacle, sleeping just outside the Holy of Holies. If this was a representation of the curtain, and this is where it was sort of before the Ark of God, he's sleeping right about where those boxes are. He'd curl up there evidently every night. That's where he would sleep. That was his house. The house of God was his house. And David, who knows all of his stories, I can't imagine that when Samuel came to pour the oil over his head, that they didn't have at least one moment where David said or at least thought, oh, Samuel, I know your story. Is it true? Dude, I might not have said dude, but did you really get a sleep by God? Did you really get to sleep right by the Holy of Holies, close enough, so to speak, to hear God's heartbeat? And I just imagine David saying, oh, that's what I want. He writes a song. He says, the one thing I desire, I want to dwell in the house of the Lord as long as I live, all the days of my life. All the days of my life. Oh, Samuel, I want what you had. He says, I want to bring God home. And so Samuel, that night, as a little boy, he hears God speaking to him. And he hears the whisper of God, Samuel. And Samuel thinks, oh, it's Eli. What does he want? It's late. He's getting old. Probably needs me to bring him a cup of water. He goes to Samuel. And he goes to Eli, and Eli says, I didn't call you. Go back to sleep. It happens three times. And then Samuel hears Eli say to him, look, buddy, I think I know what's going on here. If you hear that again, you turn towards God and you say, I'm listening. Here I am, I'm listening to you. And that began that intimate relationship that even David had too. I think it mimicked the relationship that Samuel had. So I want to overview very quickly because of the time we have left. I want to overview chapter 6. It's a short one, but you got to read it for yourself. It says in chapter 1, and you have to also read 1 Chronicles 13 and 15 because it really goes with this and gives you much, much more detail. Great detail. But it says that David gathered together in 2 Samuel chapter 6. He gathers together all the choice men of Israel, 30,000 of them, and it says in Chronicles that he had a conference with them first. He makes it very clear, I'm going to go do this, but I invite you to go along with me. What do you think? If you think God is in this and you'd like to do this, I'm not inviting anybody else to sort of endanger their life, but I'm ready to bring the Ark of God back home. So they say, yeah, we're with you. And it says, David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal, Judah, to bring up from there the Ark of God, whose name is called by the name, the Lord of hosts. That means the Lord of armies, Yahweh over all the armies of heaven. The armies, the hosts who dwell between the cherubim. That's the Ark. And so they set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab. They did it just the same way that the Philistines had done it. They used a new ox cart. Must work. We'll use a new ox cart. And they brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill from Uzzah and Ahio. The sons of Abinadab drove the new cart, and they brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, accompanying the Ark of God. And Ahio went before the Ark, and then David and all the house of Israel, this is great, they played with music before the Lord on all kinds of instruments, of fir wood, on harps, on stringed instruments, on tambourines, on sistrums, and on cymbals. They took every instrument they could find that would make noise. They took the harps that were probably something like this. They took the lyres that were something like ancient guitars. They took the trumpets, which were probably the shofar, if not also some made out of metal, and anything, cymbals, finger castanets type thing, anything that would make a joyful noise. And with that, they began this procession to bring it home. Everybody singing. David even wrote some songs for the occasion. And as they're coming, they're just rejoicing. It's finally happened, and the Ark of God is coming back where it belongs. And so far, it's so good. It's a great day of music and singing and dancing and celebration, and then disaster strikes. It says in verse 6, when they came to Nakon's threshing floor, which archaeologists believe was very, very close to the Temple Mount, very close at least to the stronghold of Jerusalem, maybe down in the valley. Maybe one of the valleys, like the valley of the Hinnom Valley or the Kidron Valley, but somewhere very close by. They're almost home, in other words. When they came to the Nakon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to the Ark of God, took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. The anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah. God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the Ark of God, and David became angry. He went from singing and rejoicing to anger because of the Lord's outbreak against Uzzah. And he called the name of the place Perez Uzzah, where Uzzah was judged to this day. And David was afraid of the Lord that day. And he said, how can the Ark of the Lord come to me? So David would not move the Ark of the Lord with him into the city of David, but David took it aside into the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. Gittite doesn't mean Gentile. We know that because Obed-Edom was not a Gentile. He was a Levite. He was a priest. He shows up later on in about three or four different lists of those that were appointed as Levitical priests. It's just his name was Obed-Edom. Take it to the closest priest that you can. What happens here? It's moving down the road, and those rocky roads of Israel, those of you that go with us on bus or the hiking tour, you're going to see what those rocky roads are like, full of ruts and rock stones everywhere. Somehow the oxen trips, somehow this cart begins to tip, and Uzzah just does what you would have done. You can't let the ark fall to the ground. I'm just going to hold it. And God strikes him dead, and he's gone. That's kind of harsh, isn't it? And David gets angry about it. How in the world can I bring it home? God, I've got a great plan. Everybody's with me. How do we do this thing? Take it aside to Obed-Edom, and we'll just chill for a while. So for 3 months, it's in Obed-Edom's house. Look at verse 11. The ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. I wonder what that looked like. It was something that was obvious because the next verse says that the messenger comes to David and said, David, Obed-Edom is just getting blessed like crazy. How did they know? Was it just a happier house and nobody's fighting in the home anymore? Or were people coming to him with gifts because the ark of God was so close? So there's some kind of blessing that was resident upon that man's household. And David says, we got to do it again. Here's where you want to turn on your own later on today and go read 1 Chronicles chapter 25, because they stop and they say, how do we do this? And somebody obviously went back and they read from the law. They said, wait a minute, we've got this all wrong. Those sticks, those holes, or the iron rings that are down here in the bottom of the, they're for running the sticks through so we can put it up on the shoulders of the priests and they can carry it. We got it all wrong. We don't use the methods of the world. We use the methods God gave us. We're going to carry it up on our shoulders. So that's what happens next here. And it says in verse 13, so it was when those bearing the ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces that they sacrificed oxen and fatted sheep. And it says in the other account in Chronicles, they did it every 6 steps. Can you imagine that? Look, from here, we're carrying the ark. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Stop. Offer an offering to God. Sacrifice an animal. Okay, let's go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Stop right there. Another animal, and all along the way, it's with these sacrifices. The sacrifices like sin offerings and thank offerings before God. Just rejoicing again that he's allowing them to bring it back home. But here's the point, they're doing it right this time. They're carrying it as it was meant to be carried, on their shoulders, close contact, but not on an ox cart. And then, oh, I love this part. Then David, in verse 14, then David danced before the Lord. What's that say? With all his might. And David was wearing the linen ephod, a linen ephod. Don't picture David in his underwear. Don't picture David in, you know, like the skivvies or boxers or something like that. That would not have been the case. In Chronicles, it says he wore a robe, but it was a linen robe. It was just common clothes, especially for the priests. He kind of dressed himself in the common clothes of those who would serve in the temple. And it was a robe, so what's going to happen next? There's a reason that his wife seems to get so upset. But he's out there, and I want to dwell on this for just a moment. He's out there dancing with all his might. That's not the way that I dance. I'm not a dancer. I dance. How many of you remember the Cosby Show? And it would always start with Bill Cosby, you know, doing some little, you know. That's about all that I can get out. I'm really not a dancer at all. Now, David was twirling and whirling and spinning. And if you're wearing a robe and you're twirling and whirling and spinning, it's a possibility if you twirl enough that the robe comes up maybe too far. Maybe that's what happens here. Look at this. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. And as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, David's wife, looked through the window and saw King David leaping and whirling before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. There's no rejoicing in this gal. What is she doing in the house when everybody else is out in the street anyway? Rejoicing that the ark is coming back. That's not her deal. That's just not her deal. There's no passion for that in her. Well, almost the rest of the chapter talks about David coming into the city, and he says, this is a day that the presence of God is here. This is the day we're going to give out presents as well. And everybody went home with a picnic basket. In the picnic basket was a chunk of meat, and there was a loaf of bread, and there was dessert. Date cakes, raisin cakes. So it was a sweet day for everybody that attended the event. And it says, David, at the end of that day, he's still not done rejoicing, and he goes home to bless his family. And as he comes up the walkway, his wife comes running out to meet him. Big smirk on her face. Not a smile on her face. Look at it down here in verse 20. Then David returned to bless his household, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David. And she said, how glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself today in the eyes of the maids of his servants, as one of those base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. I saw you out there spinning so your robe went up above your waist. I don't know how far it went up, but uncovering any part of your flesh David, how disgusting you were, how undignified you were. And David said to Michael, it was before the Lord who chose me instead of your father. Ooh, that's a little bit of a dig, wasn't it? Would you call this a little bit of royal intense fellowship between husband and wife at this point? Chose me instead of your father and all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore, I will play music before the Lord. You see the word music in your text? It's in italics. It means it wasn't there. That probably is inferring David playing music. But I love the thought of David saying even something like this. Therefore, I will play before the Lord. I'm going to enjoy the Lord. I'm going to rejoice in his presence. And I'm sorry, McCall, if you don't have that kind of a heart to enjoy the presence of the Lord, if it's just all got to be so stoic for you. I don't want to offend anybody with this, but can I just offend you? No, I mean, can I just encourage you? When you come in to a time of celebration and singing together before the Lord, can you put everything you have into that? You lift your voice up and bless God. Now, if your knees hurt, your back hurts, please sit down. We don't want anybody to hurt during worship, but the deal isn't let's all stand on our feet on concrete floors. I know that can be hard for some of you. Your feet might be aching. But even if you're sitting down, put your heart into it. Don't be a leaner in worship. This is going to make some people stop leaning. You know, where you're standing up and it's like, oh, you're leaning on the back of that chair. Why do they make us do this? Is it almost over? And then you're almost draped over the chair by the end of it. It really, sit down and enter in. David dancing before God with everything. He said, I will even play before the Lord. I'll play music before the Lord. And I will be, I love this, I will be even more undignified than this and will be humble in my own sight. But as for the maidservants of whom you have spoken, the ones you put down, by them I will be held in honor. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. Is that a sad story or what? No children for her until the day of her death, childless. I don't want to make too much of this, but that bitter woman ended barren. And I see that when people enter into bitterness and you let bitterness just take over your life, you become barren in a lot of ways. I'm not saying you won't have babies, but you won't give birth to that thing of rejoicing and joy in the presence of God. If you let bitterness come in and you go over this comparison thing, I don't know what was going on in McCall's life. She's probably still grieving over her daddy and her brothers who just died recently in battle. She's probably just missing her husband that she was ripped away from when David said, I got to have that one back. And now he's kind of put her away in a sense. And it might even be that comparison, maybe even a little disdain that David is now ruling where her dad used to rule. It doesn't seem to be a really warm relationship between these two. But she ends her life bitter and she ends her life barren. And it's just a sad thing. But what about you and me? I need to wrap up. What about you? What about me and us? Do you ever come to that time, that place in your life where you just think, there's just something missing. There is just something missing. And I want to suggest to you what it might be is what's in the box. It might be what's in the box. The grace of God. It might be what's in the box, the truth of God. The life that comes out of even the death of that twisted, dried up twig. It might be what's in the box, a provision that only comes through God, his manna every day to bless you. It might be what's over the box, the mercy seat where God calls you to come and meet with him. It might be what hovers over the box, the glory of God. And it all comes down to this decision, and I need to close. It really comes down to this. Look at it this way. You're the box. You're the box. It's my chest, my heart. If ark means chest, Lord, come into my chest, my heart, my life. Come into this box because it's empty without you. And it's useless without you. It's graceless without you. No knowledge without you, God. No wisdom without you. No life without you. I need you, God. And it starts the day that you say to him, Jesus, come into this box. You come to where? You come and meet him at the mercy seat. Where his hands were stretched out for you, where he did that deed for you so grace could be poured down upon you in bucket loads. And the grace and the life and the provision and the hope and the truth, it's all right there. Get it into the box. Get it into your heart. Open up your heart and let him take over. Amen.
This has been a presentation of Refuge Calvary Chapel Huntington Beach with Pastor Bill Welsh. For more information about our ministry, please visit refugefamily.com or call 714-891-9495.